It's Current State on WKAR. Greetings, and we're glad you're here. What does it mean that the UAW's Bob King recently, as in the last 2 weeks, reached out to State Senator Gretchen Whitmer about running for governor this year? How much or how little faith does the UAW have in candidate Mark Schauer, if that's going on? A relevant question for upcoming Current State guests. Among those guests today, WKAR Director of Broadcasting Gary Reed on our TV station's 60th anniversary, that is today, and FRIB's Thomas Glassmacher is coming up, Neighbors in Action, and more. But first, this week, we learned that the new appropriations bill drafted in the U.S. Senate includes $55 million to continue the FRIB project here at Michigan State University. It's a well-known acronym here in mid-Michigan. It stands for Facility for Rare Isotope Beams. The project will feature a large particle collider that smashes subatomic matter together to create, even for the tiniest fraction of time, elements that scientists say are the building blocks of the universe as we know it. Now, besides the scientific wow factor involved, FRIB promises a strong economic development aspect. Studies indicate the project could generate more than $1 billion in economic activity over its first decade. We have two guests this morning to talk about the FRIB project. A short while ago, I spoke with Michigan's Carl Levin by phone. Senator Levin's been a supporter of FRIB. I first asked him, though, about yesterday's collapse of efforts to hammer out an extension of benefits, unemployment benefits, for over 1 million Americans. Both Democrats and Republicans are blaming each other for negotiating in bad faith. I asked Mr. Levin what went wrong.
The unwillingness of the Republicans to agree that after they could offer a whole bunch of amendments, whatever amendments they wanted, that then there would be an end of the filibuster by them against the bill. In other words, the whole point of going through an amendment process is so that at the end of it, you can have a vote on the bill. So they wanted to be able to offer a lot of amendments. We agreed, but they wouldn't agree that then they would end the filibuster. So what's the point? And it's too bad. Many of them just don't want to extend unemployment benefits. That's clear because of the votes that we have had. I'd say probably most of the Republicans do not want this federal unemployment insurance program to continue. And that means that over 1.5 million Americans now have lost their unemployment, their federal unemployment insurance, which is most of the unemployment weeks.
Does Senator Reed mean filibustering literally?
No. When we say filibustering these days, we mean filibuster, which is the threat of the filibuster, which will lead to a real filibuster. But technically, these are not real filibusters. These are threats of filibusters. One of my points is that we ought to make them filibuster, but that has not been so far the way in which we proceeded.
I want to ask you about Senator Reed's tactics as well. He appears to have gotten off to a bad start by refusing to allow any amendments. He then went back and forth requiring simple majority votes to end debate, but then 60-vote supermajorities to approve the amendments. Senator Mitch McConnell suggested this was dysfunctional and absurd. Could Senator Reed have handled this better?
I think he did the best he can. He's dealing with a group, most of which don't want the unemployment insurance program to continue. So he's really just trying to see if we can get a few votes, a few people on the Republican side who are willing to vote for a program if we go through an extensive amendment process, which, by the way, can be far afield from unemployment. The Republicans want to be able to offer amendments to repeal Obamacare and other kinds of things which are not related to unemployment. So if you go through that whole process, then the question is, will they then agree not to filibuster the bill once you've offered and gone through an amendment process? And they would not agree to it.
Do you think you'll pursue this again later this month?
I do. I think we're going to continue to try to get this thing done.
Are you confident of an eventual extension?
No. There's too much opposition among the most Republicans. There's a handful that may vote for an extension if they get their way on certain things. But because 90% of the Republicans oppose the program and want to end the federal unemployment insurance program totally, which has resulted, by the way, in about 1.5 million Americans now losing most of their unemployment compensation. And maybe 50,000 Michiganians who've lost their assistance totally now. At any rate, because most of the Republicans oppose the program, I'm not optimistic we're going to be able to get this done. But I am determined, as every Democrat is, that we're going to continue to try.
We're talking with Senator Carl Levin here on Current State. Let's talk about the FRIB project. The $55 million needed to complete it is in the new budget. Now, back in 1993, Congress canceled funding for the superconducting super collider down in Texas after spending nearly $2 billion on the project. Is there a way to somehow prevent the FRIB from going the way of that project?
Well, we took the major step to do exactly that. We're breaking ground now on FRIB because of this the appropriations bill that we will adopt in the Senate in the next couple of days will be adopted in the House today. This is the appropriation for the total government, of course, but FRIB is a critical part of it for our country, for Michigan, for Michigan State. We're going to have 5,000 construction jobs in Michigan over the next 10 years and a couple hundred million in new tax revenues and hundreds of scientists and engineers at Michigan State. This is a huge project for the nation. It's going to keep us in the lead in the area of nuclear science. So this is the big step. This is the one which now, I believe, makes this unstoppable because construction will begin now.
But how likely is it that future federal spending on the FRIB could disappear before its completion?
I think now that's almost impossible. I don't know what the balance of the spending is, but once you make a start like this, and the start will be in the next few months, the prospect of this then suddenly ending in the middle is very, very little.
Michigan also stands to be impacted, many say positively, by a few other budget items. Do you think an increase in the Army Corps of Engineers budget could result in more harbor dredging here in the state?
It will. We did well on the dredging funds in this appropriation bill. There's a huge issue for Michigan and the Great Lakes, and so we've been working so hard on the dredging issue because the lake levels, when they've gone down, produce more dredging needs. And so, this is good news in terms of dredging our harbors in Michigan.
Now, deficit cutters complain that this new budget doesn't do anything to address the growing deficit over the long term. What do you make of that complaint?
I think that's basically true, but I think our deficits are going down now. They're a long way from getting to zero, but our deficits now for this year and the next years are now going to be going down. Our part of the deficit problem was the recession. That was a big component of it. The Bush tax cuts which mainly went to upper-income folks, but the tax cuts of the Bush administration were another big part of the deficit. Because the economy's coming back, we're going to see reductions in deficits. And so I hope that we can do more on deficit reduction, frankly. But the way we need to do that is to include some additional revenue, which I believe should come from closing these just totally unjustified tax loopholes, which allow corporations, which are highly profitable, to shift revenue and to shift assets, such as their intellectual property, to the shell corporations that they create in tax havens. And this is hundreds of billions of dollars we're talking about. So I believe that we should, including additional revenue, do more in terms of deficit reduction.
Some recent polls show Republican Terry Lynn Land in a tight race with Gary Peters for your U.S. Senate seat. How concerned are you that you might not be succeeded by a fellow Democrat?
Well, that would be very concerning, and if that happened, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that that doesn't happen and that Gary Peters, who's supremely well qualified to be a U.S. senator, wins this race despite the huge amount of the super PAC money, which is going to come in against him, this outside money by the millions, already being spent, by the way, coming in from outside groups that want to defeat him, and it's going to be a very close race, but I really hope that Gary will do it.
Senator Carl Levin, many thanks.
Sure, good being with you.
And joining us now in Studio S is Dr. Thomas Glassmacher, the project manager for the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams. Welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
What was your response when you heard of the $55 million for FRIB making it into the budget?
Well, we were very grateful because the $55 million and the appropriation in itself and the inclusion of FRIB indicates the continued congressional support that the project enjoys, both in the House and in the Senate and all over Michigan.
Did you ever have serious doubts that it may not be included?
Well, this has been a five-year process so far, so there have been moments of doubt, but we kept the goal in mind, and as we went towards this appropriation, the signs were stronger and stronger that it would be included.
Now, does this $55 million, is that earmarked to a particular part of the project?
Well, there is. It's not earmarked to a particular part, but it's earmarked to delivering the project baseline. That's the integration of cost, scope, and schedule. We have agreed with the Energy Department what we're going to do when, and we laid out a schedule that goes to 2022, and as part of that, next in this fiscal year, FY14, we will spend $55 million from DOE and $10 from the community. And it includes construction and the completion of technical design.
Now, as I think you heard in the interview with Senator Levin, 20 years or so ago, Congress canceled funding on a similarly expensive project in Texas. Do you worry about that scenario still unfolding?
I don't worry about this because this was a very different time. At that time, the cost of the project kept on escalating. It's the project's job to not exceed the cost to deliver the scope for the price on the schedule. That didn't happen in Texas. So it's really on us to avoid this. It's on us to deliver for the cost. And we have a great team. We will deliver for the cost we agreed to.
And Senator Levin, I think, described it as almost impossible that the funding would be in jeopardy at this point on.
I agree with that, as long as we execute well, and we will.
Give us an update, if you will, on the major construction elements that are already finished and what's underway now.
So we have civil construction starting in early spring. The fact that the country will work on an appropriation and no longer a continuing resolution allows new projects to start. During the last year, we were unable to start civil construction because that's not allowed under continuing resolutions. So we're getting ready to start early spring. And then in the fall, we will start technical construction. Currently, our civil design is finished and our technical design is about 60-65% done. We'll substantially finish that by the summer, have it reviewed, and then in parallel we will do civil construction on the outside, technical construction on the inside. Civil construction takes about 2.5 years till fall of 2016, at which time we will start to install the technical equipment and then manage to an early completion in December 2020.
It's not hard to understand what technical construction is. Is civil construction everything else?
Well, civil is the building. And technical is the accelerator.
Okay.
So we'll start civil in the spring and technical in the fall.
How is the effort to attract international talent to work on the FRIB coming along? Is that underway?
So we have hired about 120 people. We have hired folks from all over the country and some folks from Asia, some folks from Europe. It's underway. We have a team ready to go. We took the last 4 years to refine our design, to build our team, and to train up for the marathon that just began.
I'm curious if you would remind us of the, let's back up a little bit, remind our listeners of the practical applications of the FRIB and what that will be about.
Sure. So FRIB will accelerate any element between hydrogen and uranium to half the speed of light. Scientists will be enabled to make discoveries with rare isotopes, and some of these rare isotopes can be used for medicine, for example, for cancer treatment or for imaging. Some can be used for national security, some can be used for biology, so there'll be a lot of different applications. FRIB's role is to facilitate the discovery made by subject matter experts that work in medicine or nuclear science or astrophysics or biology. And that's what national user facilities for the Office of Science do in the Department of Energy. You provide a state-of-the-art tool, and folks from all over the country come, do peer-reviewed experiments, publish their findings, and increase human knowledge that benefits mankind.
Will you be, you are literally creating new elements?
We're creating new isotopes of the same elements. So we're taking a beam like uranium, and we break it into pieces, and the elements with a defined number of protons that come out will have numbers of neutrons which are not currently found on Earth. They used to be here. They have all since decayed. They're still made in stars, but for fractions of a second, we can recreate them, and then folks can study them.
How many of the staff that you are lining up from around the country and around the world, how many of them are many of them in East Lansing now?
They're not all. I mean, 98% of them are in East Lansing. They live here. They moved to this community. We attracted them to mid-Michigan. And the beautiful thing is, you know, it's hard to get folks from California and the East Coast to move to mid-Michigan. But we learned once we bring them here, they like it. And they find all the amenities they're used to from where they come from, but a much easier way of living. No traffic jams, a little bit less stress, and it's just nice and easy. And so we learned we need to bring them here, and we need to bring their families here, and they need to visualize themselves doing well in Lansing and East Lansing, and they do.
It's interesting to look at the two applications that you focus on when we talk about FRIB, medical on one and security on the other. Is there anything else in there where there is a potential payoff?
Sure. There is biology, there is rare studies, there is material science. It's a tool we're building, and you know, working with the engineering College of Engineering at MSU, we're working with other universities. So we have a user group of over 1,500 scientists who now, 8 years before FRIB is done, have committed to doing science at FRIB and making discoveries. And just as we build FRIB up, we need to cultivate the user community and educate the users, the scientists, about the possibilities at FRIB. So when FRIB turns on, they're going to come and make world-class discoveries.
How jealous are your other colleagues who are not working on FRIB?
I don't really know. I think.
Do you detect any?
Well, the thing to keep in mind, the nuclear science community has wanted an FRIB for 25 years. I think everybody is happy that it's finally, you know, on a path, on a defined path to be completed.
The larger nuclear science community.
That's right.
Community
the nation.
Country.
Yeah. We make 5-year plans with 10-year perspectives, and FRIB was the highest priority for new construction. And so this is not just some MSU thing. This is not just some state thing. This is really what the nuclear scientists in the country wants, and it's our job to fulfill their aspirations.
Will this trigger the creation of, or has this already triggered the creation of other mid-Michigan businesses that are somehow connected to?
So it's a little early. We're talking with LEAP, we're talking with the Chamber of Commerce, but if you look at other towns, and one of them is in Newport News, Virginia, Jefferson Lab was built 25 years ago. And that town, I remember just a Waffle House there and a cornfield, but that town has transformed itself. And so we're working with those regional entities, you know, to have some of that same impact in Lansing here.
What about funding over the longer haul, the really longer haul? I can understand why you may not be too concerned about that because it's a step-by-step process. But over the longer haul, will FRIB require significant infusions of capital?
So the FRIB project establishes the facility. That funding path is laid out. But after that, it takes about 10% of the construction cost. That's a rule of thumb to operate these national user facilities. So with a total project cost of $730 million for FRIB, so we're going to get $70 to $80 million per year from the Energy Department for the next 20 or so years after FRIB is finished in 2020. So that gets us into 2040. And the other thing I want to say, for the FRIB construction, over 60% of that is spent in Michigan, over 90% right now, over 95% in this country. So it has a direct impact on the local economy.
Very interesting. We want to thank Dr. Thomas Glassmacher, Project Manager for the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams here at Michigan State University. Nice to see you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, Ingham County officials have announced good news about the area's housing market. In a release last week, Register of Deeds Curtis Hertel Jr. reported that home sales last year were up and that foreclosures were down. Here to put those developments in greater context and to update us on his bid to become a state senator, Current State welcomes back Curtis Hertel Jr.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see you. In 2013, foreclosures down, home sales up. Put these developments in context for us, please. Why is this happening?
Well, we attribute most of the home sale increases to nuclear scientists working on the effort, but not really. The good news is the numbers are recovering for the first time since I took office. Actually, 6 years ago, when I took office, we had seen foreclosures actually triple. In this county, going from an average of 500 to 600 people losing their homes in Ingham County to between 1,500 and 1,800. And it has stayed at those numbers for the last 5 years. So to actually, for the first time in the last 6 years, we are under 1,000 people losing their home to foreclosure and a dramatic 22% increase in home sales. So that's good news. The economy in Ingham County is recovering. I think that we're going to recover faster than most places because we have a good quality of life here in Ingham County. We have good parks, good schools. We have the university here. It's a great place to live. So I think that we're going to recover faster than a lot of places in the state. And we're already seeing those numbers come in, and we're very excited about that.
Now, the unemployment rate is still higher than anyone would like, especially here in Michigan, over 8% in November. But locally, are you suggesting that the employment picture is just marginally stronger, so that and does that account for some of the improvements that you're pointing to?
We recover faster partially because of the university, and so that's a big economic driver in this community. We've made a lot of investments in tech jobs here in Ingham County and in Lansing, so I think that's helping as well. And I think that we have a good quality of life here, which is always helpful. I think that the overall state economy has been slower than we'd like to recover. I think that we need as a state to make more investments in things like public education and infrastructure. We've made those investments in Ingham County, so I would think that if the state could follow that lead, that they would recover faster as well.
A lot of the economic forecasts for 2014 are calling for a good year. Do you anticipate more improvement on the foreclosure and home sales front in calendar 2014?
Yeah, certainly on the foreclosure front. I think that we've hit the bottom. A lot of people thought we hit the bottom before, but I think we've hit it now. I think that we're going to see more people staying in their homes. We have a robust program to keep people in their homes here in Ingham County. We have financial counseling that's available to people that are in trouble. We have lawyers that are available for people that are being illegally foreclosed. So we have a multifaceted effort to keep people in their homes. So the economy is improving on one end, a lot of tools on the other end. In terms of the home sales, as long as the economy gets better, home sales are going to do better. The one thing I would say is that we have to be careful of is interest rates. And we saw a small uptick in interest rates at the end of last year, and that certainly slowed the market a little bit. If that continued to go up, I think that would have a cooling effect on the market. Mm. It's interesting because you actually, when rates go up, at the very first part of that, you see people sell quickly because they panic almost, and that if it jumps any further than that, they're afraid the market will go down and that they'll lose equity.
And we had one of those situations earlier, the middle of last year. I want to say interest rates jumped 1% in a month, if I'm not mistaken, but then they came back down
again. So, we have to be watchful of that. Most people lock in a interest rate for 30 days, so you have you lock in at the very beginning of the process, and then you move forward. So if they jump, people will tend to play the market a little bit, and so I think that in general the picture is very good. And I expect that if it's a good time to sell a home in Ingham County, and the good news is it's a good time to buy too, because prices are still relatively stagnant.
You blasted banks and various foreclosure companies during the housing collapse for abuses and incompetence. From your experience, has that improved at all since then?
No. I think that there have been attempts at improvement, but I still see a lot of incompetence out there. I still see, you know, vacant houses that are sitting for a long period of time. We have one in East Lansing that we're looking at doing some press on soon that has been sitting there for 2 years vacant, that large bank, Bank of America, has done nothing with, and letting a property rot in the middle of a community. And so we still do see cases of that out there.
But less frequently?
Certainly less frequently, because there are less houses that are being foreclosed. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the problem has been solved. And, you know, apparently David Trott, who runs the largest foreclosure firm in the state, is actually planning on running for Congress now. So, I mean, these people have influence already by making large campaign contributions. Now one of them wants to be a congressman, a person who has actually built their career off of living off human misery. So
that gives you pause.
I think that, you know, I believe in public service as a gift, and I care about the people that I serve. To elect someone to Congress who has basically lived off of other people's misery for this much time, and I'm not saying all foreclosure attorneys are bad. But in this one particular, we've seen all the cases of robo-signing and pushing people out of their homes needlessly. And I just think when you've grown that big and you've monetized, they've monetized every part of the foreclosure process. They own the paper where the foreclosures are printed in. They own the title company that does it. They found a whole way to monetize the system. And I find it interesting that they're running as a conservative when they've taken so much federal bailout money through their foreclosure processes. I mean, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are their clients. They've mm-hmm. benefited from the federal bailout more than almost anybody in the
state. They represent lenders in litigation.
Yeah, absolutely. Their job is to move the profit process along swiftly and get people out of their homes. And I'm not saying that there haven't been cases where they've done the right thing. I'm sure there are. But I can point to many cases where people have been hurt by this process to push people out of their homes faster. And I think that, unfortunately, Trott and other foreclosure mills in this state haven't done enough to protect people.
Are you following that particular race by
Absolutely.
Any chance?
It's a fascinating
Trott
race.
Trott versus Kerry Benevolio in the 11th congressional district.
Yes, but you know the Dems have a good candidate as well. It's not the easiest district in the world, but I think the Republicans have two very flawed candidates. So we have a former military national security expert running as well. So I think it's going to be an interesting race, and I look forward to keeping an eye on it. Yeah, I'm a creature of this kind of stuff.
Are you encouraged by the prospects for gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer?
Absolutely. I support Mark strongly.
What do you make of the UAW's ongoing courtship of Gretchen Whitmer to run for governor?
Well, you know, I mean, I love Gretchen Whitmer, too. It's certainly not a slight on her, but she's a strong supporter of Mark Schauer as well. I attended a fundraiser for Mark Schauer at Gretchen Whitmer's house. So I know that Gretchen is supporting Mark. And I think that, you know, Gretchen's focus is on picking up seats in the state Senate, where we're down to 12 seats right now and a super minority. And we have a lot of opportunities to pick up seats in the state. So I think that's where Gretchen's focus is, and I think Mark, we have a great candidate for governor. I'm excited about this year. I think we have a great chance to win the governorship. And I certainly think the Republicans have given us plenty of ammunition, and I'm looking forward to getting out on the campaign trail and talking about it.
But it must concern you that the UAW, in particular, has apparent doubts about the guy most Democrats are trying to rally around and generate support for.
Listen, it's a difficult process to get the endorsement of an organization as large as the UAW. You know, there are all the different regions you have to work with. You know, I'm proud that we've gotten the endorsement of the UAW, but I only have to work with one region. So there's a lot of inside baseball here and how it actually works. I would say that, you know, having spoken to members, UAW members that are out working, I think that they're happy that Mark Schauer is running. I mean,
really?
He's got a very good record on labor issues and standing up for the auto industry. And Norwood Jewell, who is the Region 1C director, who is, you know, the person who runs the region here for Lansing, stood up and said, if it wasn't for Mark Schauer, we wouldn't have an auto industry in this state. And I think that's true. And I think that no one's been a bigger supporter of the auto industry and labor than Mark Schauer. So
it's interesting because apparently one of the concerns is Mr. Schauer's ability to fundraise, but it would seem to me that the UAW could play a significant role in
They're certainly one of the major funders of the party. You know, I would say this. He's got $1 million in cash on hand.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how bad politics has gotten in this state where $1 million isn't a lot of money, more than just under a year out. But I think that's a pretty good number. It's certainly more than any candidate had 4 years ago when we were running for governor. You know, Jennifer Granholm was a stalwart fundraiser, so I think that sometimes we expect to have another Jennifer Granholm. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think he's raised, you know, over $1 million. He's going to have matching funds through the primary, and then we keep going. But you know, money is important in politics. It certainly is an indicator of how you're going to do. But I know Mark Schauer. I've worked with Mark Schauer before. He is one of the best grassroots, hardest workers that I've ever met on the campaign trail. And I think that translates as well. And I think he's a real person that I think would be an interesting contrast to the governor, who can seem to be aloof sometimes.
It'll be interesting to see as well. Vice President Biden is in Detroit today
Yes.
for a fundraiser for the Democratic candidate. Speaking of mountains of money, if it were your call, how would you earmark the $900 million Michigan budget surplus? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we've made a lot of de-investments in this state over the last 4 years that we need to start reinvesting in. So my first priority would be funding public education. I think that there have been a lot of cuts to the education, and that we have a unique opportunity to actually make investments. That being said, a lot of this money is one-time use money. You know, they're talking about actually two-thirds of it being only a one-time gain. So you can't make too many long-term investments. You have to be careful. But I think this idea of making a permanent tax increase based on 1 year of good budgeting just doesn't make any sense.
Tax, you know, tax decrease.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Tax decrease. I apologize. But, you know, you look at, you know, Governor Snyder has talked about wanting to run this economy like a bit, run this state like a business. If you had a 2% increase in sales 1 year, you wouldn't reinvest it immediately the next year, which is what they're basically trying to talk about by putting it into long-term tax savings. I just don't think it's a good plan. I think it's an election year gimmick. And hopefully the governor will stand up on this one to members of his own party that are pushing for this. Unfortunately, what I've seen in the past is this governor talks a good game, says that, you know, things like tax cuts aren't on his priority list, but then on situations like right to work, caves to the right. So I hope he won't do that in this situation. I know, you know, election years are tough. People like gimmicks in election years. But I think any permanent tax decrease with this money just isn't responsible. And if you're going to do it, you should target it to places that'll help the middle class.
What about a rebate, a direct rebate to taxpayers? Gretchen Whitmer has said she doesn't have a real major problem with that.
Well, I guess you have to decide what you want to do with it and will it actually benefit the long term. I would say this. The average rebate check that a person's going to get based on what the actual amount that's out there is less than $100. You know, I mean, is that going to affect anyone's life in any major way? Is that going to fix our economy? I think the answer is no. So you have a chance to either invest the money in something that will actually improve our economy and actually take the state forward, or you can give everybody a check for $85. I think the average person, at least in my family, would prefer that you actually invest it in somewhere that's going to help the state as a whole. So, you know, I don't think rebates are bad. I think sometimes they can be good even. But when it's that small of money and you don't know if it's going to come back next year, they're actually saying that the way the budgets are set up, they might have a $400,000 hole next year, or a $400 million hole next year already. So a $400 million hole, the surplus is already half gone by the time you pay that. So you have to be careful. And, you know, an election year, everyone wants to do something that's going to be popular. I'm sure writing everybody an $85 check is popular, but I'm not so sure it's good for the state.
What will you be listening to for most closely in the State of the State address?
I think that the governor needs to lay out a plan for improving education in the state. You know, we've talked about expanding early education. We haven't exactly found the funding to do that.
He could very well assign some of this budget surplus to education. That wouldn't surprise you, would it?
No, it wouldn't surprise me, and I hope he does. I hope they can backfill some of the holes that they've created in our public education system or across the state. We also need to look at anybody who's driven on the roads since the ice storm knows that we have some major problems both here in this area and on the highways. We need to make some investments there, and I'm hoping that he'll lay out a plan to do that.
Curtis Sertell Jr. is Ingham County Register of Deeds, and he is a candidate, the Democratic candidate to replace Gretchen Whitmer in the Senate 23rd District here in Michigan. Curtis, thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you. WKAR. It's Wednesday and time for Current States Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we learn about the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. The coalition's been helping children and adults in the Lansing area learn to read for more than 30 years, and here to tell us more about the Capital Area Literacy Coalition, its founder and executive director, Lois Bader. Welcome, Lois.
Hi, Mark. Good to be here.
Same here. Tell us about how you started the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. What motivated you to
Actually, I didn't do it single-handed, of course, and nothing major is accomplished with one person.
This is your chance to take full credit for the whole thing.
Right. But, well, you know, I've been around so long that some of the people that know better are gone. but seriously, Barbara Bush, that became the first lady's concern was literacy, and they started up across the nation. I think the libraries got some money for a little while to, you know, have a location for the literacy groups. And so one of my doctoral students said, you better get downtown and get involved, because she said they could go down the wrong path pretty easily. So I didn't know about that. But so I started with a group of people. And when we started out, we were only serving people 16 and over who were no longer in school. And I realized that if this organization was going to survive, we had to diversify. We also had to take care of children and teens and do GEDs and work on English as a second language. And so bit by bit, I wrote additional programs, and now we're at the full service area that we are right now.
Tell us about the key services that you provide. Where does the majority of your energy get focused?
Actually, we tried to spread it out pretty easily because all of our programs are very important to us. The GED is a very, very great concern, and I know you interviewed our coordinator, Katie Stecker, here recently, and that's a tremendous concern. Without the GED or high school equivalency, these people are absolutely doomed as far as their financial lives are concerned. It's going to be very, and they know it. They're coming into the office pleading with us to give them some help. Give them some help immediately. These people are usually very, very poor. We often have to give them a bus token. They have young children, and it's just very urgent for them.
There have been changes in the GED recently. What do you make of those?
I'm not very happy about them. The GED originally came about from the after World War II, the veterans who had dropped out to go to war needed a credential to go to college. And so a nonprofit organization took care of the GED for a number of years. Now it's being taken over by a for-profit company, which is Pearson. Happened to be my publisher, too. But now the cost of the GED is double. And this is a burden for students. It's a burden for organizations trying to help them. There are alternatives to the new GED, and what I'm hoping in Michigan is that since they've already approved our giving the new GED, they will also approve one of the alternates. The GED can only be taken by on computer, and so many states across the country are approving an alternate high school equivalency test that doesn't have to be taken on computer. Some states are approving two or three tests that can be given. So I am hoping that Michigan will approve another test so that if things aren't going well with this new test, which is supposed to be very, very hard, we would have an alternative one.
From your vantage point, we're talking with Lois Bader, the director of the Capital Area Literacy Coalition here on Current State's Neighbors in Action. From your point of view, Lois, how prevalent is illiteracy and poor literacy here in the Lansing area?
Well, generally, the figure that's put out in Lansing and across Michigan has been about 20%. But they're considering people reading on the sixth grade level as being literate. Now, with the workplace changing, that could change. But if we take the 20% of the total Tri-County population, we're talking about 92,807 individuals. United Way put out a figure a couple years ago that about 960 people are dropping out per year, so you can multiply that. But it's not just the number of people that we count reading on a sixth grade level. I have in front of me the Department of Labor report that states that over one-third of the U.S. population cannot perform such activities as writing a letter explaining an error on a credit card, using a bus schedule, or using a calculator to determine a 10% discount. So as they document, this shortfall in skills translates to ability to do well in the job market. Mm-hmm.
What are the barriers, though? Talk to us a little bit more about the barriers that keep people from becoming adequately literate.
Well, one of our programs, a very important one, is the Read to Succeed program. And we do have a large number of university students that help us with that. We tutor children in the Lansing School District who are in extreme poverty, who are failing to learn to read. There are some children who have never been read to. They might be in first or second grade and not know the alphabet. They're coming from homes that are extremely poor. About 28% of our students last year came from homes where the income level was less than $10,000 a year. So poverty has always been the major predictor of illiteracy, mm-hmm. and it certainly is there. The good news of that is that when we tutor these children and have them matched one-on-one with a trained supervised tutor, they do excel. They get up on grade level. Our challenge is to get more tutors. The more people that we have volunteer, the more children we can save.
And how many volunteers do you have? How can volunteers get involved with your effort?
Well, we have a web page, thereadingpeople.org, and they can simply call the office or email us, and we'll be happy to get them started. Actually,
do you have enough volunteers? Do you feel you're short?
We are short volunteers for English as a second language, for GED, for the Read to Succeed program. We are short of volunteers in all of our programs because we have waiting lists. Mm. And so also, I can still give university credit to people who want to work with us, and that's been a big help too. But yes, we definitely need more volunteers.
TheReadingPeople.org is the website for the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Where does your funding come from, Lois?
Well, wherever we're not standing on the corner with a tin cup yet, but we may get to that point. I don't know. We apply for grants. We have an annual appeal. Every other year, DART has a bowl-a-thon for us. We just apply wherever, you know, we think we have a possibility of funding. So, you know, we did a little bit better on the annual appeal this year, and I was rather surprised because I thought with the ice storm that we wouldn't do as well. But we have some supporters who are loyal to us.
Lois Bader is the founder and executive director of the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Lois, nice to see you. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to see you, Mark. Bye. Thank you.
Sure. We could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing excellent work. Current State needs to know about them. Help us out. Send us an email about these great nonprofits in the area to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Music there by Uncle Tupelo. The track is called Sandusky. Here on Current State on 90.5 WKAR, our television colleagues here at WKAR are celebrating a milestone today, and Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now to explain. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Mark. 6 decades ago today, WKAR-TV went on the air in mid-Michigan. Interestingly enough, the FCC gave us the technical name Ultra High Frequency Channel 60, very apropos. On January 15th, 1954, we launched our new station with a transmitter antenna that was taller than the Eiffel Tower. I chatted with your boss and mine, MSU Director of Broadcasting Services Gary Reed, about how it all got started.
Well, you know, Kevin, at that particular time, it made sense to have a TV station at a university simply because it was new technology, and this was cutting edge for a university. Television in a functional sense had been around for several decades, but in a real practical, usable sense, it was less than 10 years. And for WKAR to come on at Michigan State University was a huge advance in technology.
The Michigan Public Broadcast Stations, through the facilities of WKAR Television East Lansing, present An Evening with the Governor. This special one-hour conversation with Michigan Governor William G. Milliken comes to you from the executive residence in Lansing. The host for this series is political affairs editor and Capitol correspondent Tim Skubick.
What did you think personally of the mafia and the CIA working hand-in-hand to kill Mr. Castro?
Well, I have some very serious questions about the way the CIA has been functioning all over the world.
We've had a few programs here at WKAR-TV that have really stood the test of time. The one that stands out in my mind is Off the Record. We've had Off the Record on for almost 42 years.
The thing, Kevin, that I would mention about a weekly program, 52 weeks a year, that deals with politics is to remain relevant.
Capital correspondent Tim Skubin.
Michigan's only legislative and political analysis forum.
Political affairs editor Tim Skubin.
Tim Skubin has been able to do that with Off the Record, and that's exactly what we've tried to do with every one of our shows. And I think that's just the important part of public broadcasting, the need to make sure that we are providing information of interest, of value, that really creates the heart of what our community is.
Orquesta Ritmo, coming up next on Backstage Pass.
Welcome to Current Sports. I'm your host, Al Martin. This is our Current Sports Rose Bowl special. And yes, we are here on a beautiful day in Los Angeles, California, 80 degrees.
Gary Reed is the Director of Broadcasting Services at Michigan State University, which encompasses both WKAR radio and TV. WKAR-TV is celebrating 60 years today. Gary, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin.
For Current State, this is Kevin Lavery.
Extra special here today to catch back up with Dr. Lois Bader of the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. We're standing here after the interview reminiscing about the class I took from Dr. Bader when she was on the faculty here at Michigan State University, an Ed College grad. I am an Ed College grad here of MSU, and she did a reading endorsement class the summer of 74, and I've never forgotten the class, so it's extra special to have her back to talk about what she's been doing since. That's our show for today. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Instroth is our producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. Also, a big thank you to Aaron Young for engineering and Hannah Michaeljohn for production assistance. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Current State. Thanks for listening. This is 90.5 WKAR.